The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, September 2019, Volume 20, Number 9, and this is the first of four installments. Gail King shares this month's cover with Oprah. Both are wearing antique gold metallic sweater dresses. Gail's is sleeveless with a crew neck, and Oprah's is long-sleeved with a stand-up collar. Gail's layered haircut with its soft bangs glows with soft caramel highlights, as does Oprah's shoulder-length, smooth and gently wavy cut. Their makeup is bronze and smoky with deep coral lipstick. This month's headline reads, "The Key to Lasting Friendship and Why Gail and I Have It for Sure." The big wide O for Oprah Magazine sits on a gold rectangle in the upper left-hand corner of the cover. And behind the scenes of this month's cover, we have pictures of Gail and Oprah in the dressing room, looking into the mirrors with the big white globe light bulbs, dressed and coiffed and made up. And there's a quote here from Oprah, "There's rarely a day when Gail doesn't make me laugh." The perfect blend ship. Oprah says, "During their 43 years of friendship, Oprah Winfrey and Gail King have seen each other through births and deaths, marriage and divorce, fame and fortune, ill-conceived haircuts, more than a few great dogs, and approximately 17 bazillion phone conversations. They've shared holidays, secrets, and clothes. They've been side by side on every continent but Antarctica. The one thing they've never done together, appear on this magazine's cover until now." Oprah said at the photo shoot, quote, "I couldn't do an issue celebrating friendship without my BFF. Well, I'm thrilled to be here," Gail answered. They went quiet for a minute as hair was fiddled with and blush touched up. And then Gail cut to the chase with that deepest of questions, central to virtually every friendship since the dawn of time. "So where do we feel like eating tonight?" Now, here's another picture of Gail and Oprah with their black drapes while their makeup's being done. For more great Gail and Oprah moments, check out their interview from the August 2006 issue, a candid conversation all about their legendary friendship. Yes, they address those old rumors at oprahmag.com/Oprah-Gail-Throwback. And then to get the look, they have one of those rolling hanging racks with about a dozen and a half sweater dresses on them, and they're all in shades of grays and blush pinks, and one of them's kind of a burnt orange, getting into sort of fall colors. So perfect for fall, our Cover Girl's flowy and form-fitting dress options stayed in neutral territory. And then right below that is a picture of a pot of Olay lotion and several brushes and like eyebrow pencils. The secret to a flawless complexion? Prepping your face with an ultra-hydrating skin-smoothing cream. Olay Regenerist Whip Face Moisturizer SPF 25, $39, go to Olay.com. Also protects with a broad spectrum sunscreen. And when we go to Oprah's opening comments under Here We Go, we have Oprah and Gail sitting at Oprah's dining room table. Well, kitchen table, I think this is, but there are white linens and white plates and candles and silver service and wine glasses. Gail's in a lime green t-shirt and glasses, and she's holding up her plate, and Oprah's sitting there holding her wine glass with her hand propped on her left hand, her chin propped on her left hand. And here's what Oprah says. "It's rare that I make a big decision without asking Gail King for her input. Of course, even if I didn't ask, Gail would offer. That's the kind of person she is, and that's fine with me. After all these years, I know I can count on her counsel, rely on her judgment, and depend on her taste. The taste part, I mean literally. I recently hired a new chef after a year-long search. As you might imagine, Gail was among the first people I invited to my table to sample his work. Chef Raymond knew just how to win her over. After he heard she liked peaches, he made her a special peach salad to go with our perfectly delicious pan-roasted sea bass. Sealed the deal. If Gail had disliked Raymond's food, would I have made the same decision? Well, I'll say this. If she disagrees with me with something I want to do, it gives me pause. The reverse is true, too. The few times Gail has ignored my advice, she says she's regretted it. The trust we've cultivated is hard to describe and hard to find. It's part of what makes our friendship so special and such a sustaining force in both our lives. I don't follow Gail on Instagram because I don't follow anyone on Instagram. In our friendships, that would be a major problem. In ours, it's not even a blip. But technology surely has changed the way we interact with the people we love, hence this month's guide to being a good friend circa 2019. Here's to all the BFFs out there, the people who want nothing but the best for each other, whether what's at stake is a job, a marriage, or just a serving of sea bass. May you always have a true friend in your corner, and may you savor the privilege of being one to someone else. Enjoy, Oprah. And now let's start out the contents of this first installment with 10 titles to pick up now from the reading room. 1. The World Doesn't Require You by Rian Amilcar Scott. These terrifyingly funny stories set in a fictional Maryland town, including a daring novella about a disgraced professor plotting to upend a historically black university status quo, comprise not just a dynamic collection, but a whole haven for misfits. 2. Black Light by Kimberly King Parsons. In 12 tales as dark as crude oil, Parson illuminates the addictions and desires of rough-and-tumble Texan women. Among them, an alcoholic who sees doom everywhere after she begins dating a doctor, and a high schooler who falls for her friend and fears being outed by her brutish brother. The third title, Chances Are, by Richard Russo. As summer crowds disperse from Martha's Vineyard, a trio of 66-year-olds grapples with the secrets and sins of their youth. Russo, the Pulitzer Prize-winning chronicler of middle-class malaise, has crafted a morality tale inside a suspense story with echoes of Chappaquiddick. The fourth title, Motherland, by Alyssa Altman. The James Beard Award winner and author of Poor Man's Feast serves up a deliciously wry memoir of her codependent relationship with her mother, a woman who takes pleasure in dispelling her daughter's, quote, Rockwellian Thanksgiving fantasy, end of quote. The fifth title, Doxology, by Nell Zink. A master of compassionate satire bestows another off-kilter epic, this time centering on a pair of aging punk rockers wrestling with dreams deferred and raising a daughter amid the destabilizing din of 21st century life. The sixth title, The Yellow House, by Sarah M. Broom. While New Orleans is famous for its beignets, Sazeracs, and jazz, this exquisite memoir shines a spotlight on a neglected neighborhood and one family's engrossing odyssey through the second half of the American century, with three indefatigable women at the wheel. The fourth title, Haben, by Haben Girma. The deaf-blind daughter of an Eritrean refugee and an Ethiopian immigrant, Girma has redefined disability on her own, yielding her own unyielding terms, playing hide-and-seek as a child, climbing an iceberg in Alaska, and graduating from Harvard Law. This autobiography by a millennial, Helen Keller, Teams with Grace and Grit. The eighth title, The Trojan War Museum, by Ice Papatia Bukak. A chorus of ghost girls. A young woman dispatched to Appalachia to tend to her dying grandmother. Greek gods as conniving as teenagers. Bukak's luminous debut taps folklore and real life to flesh out complex characters with an agile, inventive hand. The ninth title, The Way Through the Woods, by Long Lit Woon. A Malaysian woman mourns the death of her Norwegian husband by foraging for mushrooms, from morals to yellow nights. In this singular memoir, in which the author becomes a, quote, traveler in the fungi kingdom, end of quote. And the tenth and final title, The Plateau, by Maggie Paxson. Villagers in a rugged corner of World War II France spirited Jewish children to safety, led by a pacifist who paid with his life. This radiant anthropological history unearths the community's tradition of caring for the displaced and reflects on whether goodness is innate. And on a sidebar here on this page, we have a poetry pause. And this is from the book Come Closer and Listen, New Poems by Charles Simic. And here's the quote. Too long I've sought what I had no name for, till one day I unclenched my fist and found a grain of sand in it. Whose joke is this? I couldn't say. And now we head to the special feature section of the magazine and the creative Oprah-O that the folks have put together at Oprah Magazine this month makes us look like we are at the bottom of the seabed with a coral. Well, it's a collage of different types of corals in really, really lovely tropical colors. And they form this arch that looks like the Oprah-O, and we have a few bright tropical fish swimming around above the sand and the dark blue sea and a few little air bubbles. September 2019, there are plenty of fish in the sea, but how many got you through your worst breakup? Our guide to friendship in the digital age will keep your BFF ships going swimmingly. And then we have three women who help their friends get eye-popping makeovers. And Oprah talks to author Malcolm Gladwell about how we perceive and sometimes tragically misperceive each other. So let's start out with The Friendship Zone, a present-day primer on nurturing, savoring, and decoding your relationships with your best pals. Though so many of us are suckers for romance, friendships may be the true love stories, the bonds that really complete us. A friend knows our secret aspirations, petty aggravations, every daily triumph and despair. She's our memory bank, moral compass, and reassurance that we aren't the only person on earth who's equally passionate about season one of Outlander, putting more women in Congress, and Hot Pockets. A good friend exerts a gravitational force in our lives, even or especially in moments when everything threatens to fly apart. She pulls us back to ourselves. Quote, we see our friends and our friends see us with a clarity that other people don't, not even our romantic partners. To be known that way is incredibly important. Friendship helps us define who we are, end of quote. And this is from Lauren Meckling, whose novel, How Could She, explores the complexities of female friendship. But these days, it's getting harder for us to define what friendship itself is. Social media has turned friend into a verb, not just a thing that we are, but a thing that we do or undo, as in the Orwellian-sounding unfriend. On Instagram, we connect with strangers who invite us to join them where we used to hang with our nearest and dearest, in the dressing room at Target, on the couch at 1 o'clock. Meanwhile, our actual friends sometimes look like strangers, flatteringly filtered, perpetually hashtag blessed, and often having too much fun with other filtered hashtag blessed people who don't happen to be us. in this universe of Insta intimacy. It's good to remember that friendship is still a matter of the heart, not heart emojis, and as such must be handled with care. That's the spirit in which we crafted our guide to being a better friend in the digital age. Because in the vast reaches of cyberspace, the network that matters most is yours. And here's our first tip. Use the tech. So much has been written about how technology is weakening the delicate fabric of human relationships, heads buried in screens, conversations replaced by keyboards. But the truth is, it can do wonders to knit us closer together. Remember the girlhood dream of staying friends forever? And that four is written with the number four. Our apps and devices can make that dream come true, offering a connection to people you thought were lost to the sands of time. Your bestie from third grade, who was always sticking up for the kids who got bullied, she's now a public defender with four rescue cats and a lively social media life, and she'd be thrilled for you to get in touch. Today, we can take our friends with us everywhere, virtually. One FaceTimes you from London, walking you through Tate Modern. Others group text while watching Big Little Lies, quote, together, sharing reactions in real time. We can stream and snap our way into each other's lives with next to no effort. Of course, the existence of all this bridge-building tech doesn't mean you can skip out on spending time with your dearest pals, IRL. The offline touch is especially vital when they're in need. Khalil Gibran called friendship, quote, a sweet responsibility, end of quote, which nails both its benefits and its obligations. If your friend is dealing with something big, divorce, a death, a troubled child, a career shift, your job is to be with her in person or at least call. Yes, even if you're crazy busy or hate the phone. Your voice on the other end of the line is more powerful than any text. FYI, psychology professor Albert Mehrabian found that 38% of communication about feelings occurs through vocal tone. Texts, emails, and DMs are like emotional cliff notes. They give an outline of the story, not the full sentiment behind it. In person or on the phone, you can hear your friend's unguarded thoughts, pauses, sighs. Research has found that it can take over 200 hours together in person before someone becomes a close friend, and that's not an investment you want to squander. Just as you wouldn't conduct a romantic relationship virtually, you can't sustain a friendship that way. Keep in mind, tiny moments add up. Have a minor revelation? Quote, I just realized I've been mixing up Jeff Daniels and Jeff Bridges for the last decade, end of quote. Texter. Blips of contact are the dabs of emotional glue that keep your connection solid. Kathy Guys-White says, quote, in my closest friendships, we can obsess over anything for any amount of time. And this is Kathy of the Kathy, cartoonist and author of 50 Things That Aren't My Fault, a collection of candid essays on womanhood. She goes on to say, quote, when my niece graduated from high school, my sister planned her party down to the tiniest detail. She'd text me photos of napkins as she walked through Party City. That's exactly the kind of thing we bond over. And then there's an app for that. Voxer lets you send quick audio messages to a friend that she can listen to at her leisure. No phone call required. And here's the second item in our primer on friendship. But remember, that person on the screen is not your friend. Yes, the woman in those Instagram posts looks like your buddy Kim. Same mole near her left eye, same habit of snorting when she laughs. But she is not actually Kim. She's a meticulously crafted avatar, a presentation of the woman Kim wishes she were, or the woman she was in late 2004, or the woman she feels pressured to seem to be. In the social media era, many of us feel compelled to offer up our most charming, carefree, Ashtanga-practicing selves to the world. That presentation can be at odds with the way our real-life friends know us, sometimes creating a jarring dissonance. It can be disorienting, for instance, to watch a friend perform marital bliss on social media when she spends half your conversations fretting about her jerk of a husband. But before you judge her for being a phony, think of the pressure she must be feeling to keep up appearances. Real Kim may need your forbearance for Screen Kim's behavior. Social media just isn't the setting for the kind of authenticity and vulnerability that's the bedrock of true friendship. That knowledge will help when Screen Kim fails to provide online evidence of your friendship. Author Lauren Meckling vacationed with a close friend's family in Italy a year ago. After returning home, Meckling plastered her Facebook page with pictures. Her friend did not. Meckling says, quote, "I was shocked and hurt. Why didn't she want to brag about our cool vacation and the fact that we grilled fish together and listened to Sicilian accordion players? It bothered me so much that I finally brought it up, and she explained that her father didn't like how she looked in the photos. She was trying to protect, didn't like how he looked in the photos. She was trying to protect his feelings," end quote. One last thing about Real Cam. It's not fair to make her take a backseat to your on-screen persona. As we mine our daily lives for content and image, and imagine how it'll play out on an internet stage, we sometimes fail to fully be present in what happens around us. She's confessing to troubles with her boss, and you're mentally concocting an Instagram post about her, quote, "super fun, hashtag ladies night, hashtag yum, hashtag love my friends," end of quote. But the phantom eyeballs of your online followers aren't nearly as important as the ones you're looking into across the table. So let your paella go unphotographed occasionally. The likes you'll garner aren't worth the distance you might create between you and the people you truly hold dear. And we have about a half a dozen different terms for friendship in the modern age under the heading Terms and Conditions, our unscientific glossary for friendship's modern age. The first of the six, the barnacle, an acquaintance who wants to get too close too fast, known for persistent DMs, daily texts, and liking 12 of your Instagram photos in rapid succession. Don't be this person. And if a barnacle latches onto you, disengage until they move on to a more willing host. And the second one, FOBO, fear of being boxed out. Watching two friends fawn over each other on social media and experiencing the panic-inducing realization that they might like each other more than you. Instead of spitefully shunning both, nurture your relationships with each. The third one, GPS sisterhood. Friendships that are situational, whether job, school, or neighborhood-based, and die off when the necessary conditions change. This happens. It's nobody's fault. Enjoy the relationship while it lasts. The fourth one, antisocial butterfly. A classic extrovert who actually has few ultra-close pals. Reach out to her for one-on-one time when she can let down her guard a bit. And the fifth one, the David Copperfield, a disappearing act in which someone becomes progressively more difficult to reach via text and email until they disappear entirely. Similar to ghosting, but more gradual. There are countless benign reasons you may be Copperfielded, so try not to take it too personally. And finally, Pandora's email, an incendiary message that delves into all the faults of a friend you're angry at, which you accidentally send directly to said friend. Do damage control by picking up the phone and calling ASAP to apologize, explain, and prostrate yourself. Do not add more textual fuel to the fire. And now, the third element of this primer. Just say no to FOMO. You know how horrible it felt when Tina Capicola didn't invite you to her Sweet 16 and you had to hear about it at school later while gritting your teeth hard enough to create a diamond? Thanks to social media, you can now regularly experience that emotion as an adult. We have immediate front row seats at beach getaways we weren't asked to attend. And the pang of exclusion stings just as badly now as it did back when you used Jean Nate. Do yourself a favor and try a little perspective. Pre-internet, this kind of thing happened all the time. You were just blissfully unaware. Speaking of awareness, this is a good time for a self-audit. There could be a simple reason you weren't invited. Maybe the group assembled to obsess over a novel you haven't read, but it could also be more personal and complex. Is there a lingering grudge you and your friend haven't addressed? Maybe you've been distant lately, and she thought you were pulling away. Have you been spilling her secrets? Dominating chats with 20-minute diatribes about how maybe it's finally time for you to get Botox? Keep in mind, too, that you've probably caused FOMO yourself with no negative intentions. Give your friend the same pass you'd want to receive. If you can't stop licking your wounds, it's fair to bring up your agita nicely with those who left you out. Actor Busy Phillips, who has 1.8 million Instagram followers and considerably fewer close friends, says, quote, "One night several years ago, my Instagram blew up with photos from everyone I knew at a friend's party, and I hadn't been invited. My feelings were really hurt, so a couple days later, I called the person and said, 'I need to talk to you because it feels like this is a thing.' It turned out that it was, and we got to the bottom of it, and we got through it." End of quote. And now the fourth and final item in the primer. Kill them with kindness. Social anthropologist Laura Aramian and sociologist Peter Mallory have studied the reasons friendships fail and found three recurring issues that can cause a downward spiral. An imbalance in effort or affection. One always reaches out to schedule lunches. The other can't be bothered. Differing expectations. Michelle doesn't think twice about calling Liz every day to complain about relationship drama. Liz sees that as a ludicrous burden. And problems with overlap. Resentments about deadlines or workloads making things awkward between coworkers. Inspired by Marie Kondo, people are doing the painful emotional work of parting with things that no longer mean what they once did. But those things can't take it personally when they're heaped into a hefty bag. The process of breaking up with a friend, on the other hand, is a psychological minefield that can cause long-lasting injury. One reason is simply that we know our friends so well. Research has shown that we're better at describing our friends' creative skills and intelligence levels than they are themselves. Laura Meckling says, quote, "If you have to fire an employee or break things off with a romantic partner, they can tell themselves it's been subjective, superficial, or nonsensical reasons. But you and your friends know each other so deeply that if one rejects you, it's hard not to feel that she's seeing something in you that she doesn't like, something you might not even have found within yourself." End of quote. If you're the one doing the rejecting, you owe it to your friend to proceed with extreme benevolence and care. Before you decide to part, ask yourself if you can let your grievances go. If being spared your pal's critiques of your outfits is worth losing her impeccable sense of humor. Busy Phillips says, quote, "I pick my battles. You can't call people out for every single thing, like posting too many selfies. Sometimes you have to be like, okay, she needs some kind of validation that I can't give her right now, so I'm just going to sit back and let this pass. I've gone through phases where I'm sure I'm not that cool to be around either." End of quote. You can lie low, dialing back the frequency of your calls and emails in the hopes of conveying how close or distant you'd like to be without having to get explicit. Whatever grievances you can't let go of, don't hash them out on screen. Since online conversations lack the nuance that face-to-face or phone conversations offer, minor email or text misunderstandings can turn into full-fledged warfare. Psychologists also warn of, quote, online disinhibition, end of quote, the tendency to be bolder and more open and sometimes more aggressive when you can't see someone's face or hear their voice. In other words, the email you'd write to a friend you're peeved at will likely be much more barbed than what you'd say if you were telling her off in person. No matter the disagreement, it won't be solved by broadcasting your annoyance to your 236 Facebook friends. And if you eventually make amends, that public record of your clash will remain like a gruesome scar. But if the friendship has run aground and you're ultimately unwilling or unable to bring it back to sea, if things have become endlessly contentious or painful, it's probably time to call it quits. It should go without saying that this is not a text message situation. What situation it is depends on numerous factors: your emotional closeness, the problem at hand, the personalities of the key players. Each friendship breakup is as unique as a thumbprint and as complicated as a trigonometry equation. Consider whether this is a time to be direct in person, send a judicious email, or quietly slip away. Your friend is likely to scrutinize whatever you do or say as intensely as if it were the Zapruder film, so be respectful and merciful. Some breakups are just the natural order of things. Roz Chast, illustrator of Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It, a collaboration with longtime friend and writer Patty Marks, says, quote, I had a friend in high school who was brilliant and very bossy. We had some fights over the years, and after a particularly bad one, without any explanation, we just stopped talking. Sometimes a friendship, especially if it's very complicated, doesn't end all wrapped up in a nice, neat package with a bow on it, end of quote. And if you're on the receiving end of a breakup, take comfort in the fact that friendship can work in mysterious ways. Marx says, quote, Once a friend didn't talk to me for about a year and never explained why. I didn't ask because I thought, it's not going to be a good reason. It's not, I love you so much that I can't bring myself to talk to you. And eventually, she started talking to me again, end of quote. And now we have six companion commandments. Thou shalt not post a photo in which your friend has a double chin or is holding a margarita in a foot-tall plastic cup with a crazy straw. Thou shalt not leave effusive, encouraging comments on the post of your dear friend's enemy or ex. Thou shalt not divulge personal details on a friend's Facebook page, no matter how badly you're wondering, how did Gary's vasectomy go? Thou shalt not make up a cockamamie excuse to cancel plans, forget said excuse, and then post a photo of yourself at the botanical gardens grinning under a cherry blossom tree. Thou shalt not keep your phone on the table during dinner unless you're waiting for a call from the hospital or the governor. A 2012 study found that having a phone present during a conversation caused lower levels of trust and empathy, even if it was never used. And finally, thou shalt not clog your group text with 18 irrelevant messages per day. Some of us have jobs, Joanne. And next, we have the O interview, Oprah Talks to Malcolm Gladwell. Since the publication of The Tipping Point nearly two decades ago, Malcolm Gladwell has made a career of writing books that drive the cultural conversation. His latest offers a provocative take on what close encounters between strangers have to teach us, and how we can get better at reading each other's signals. Oprah sat down with the author and creator of the popular podcast, Revisionist History, to talk about some of his surprising conclusions. And we have a picture here of Oprah standing outside under some massive trees with lots of shade being cast by all the full leaves on the trees. She's standing next to Malcolm. He's a very slender man, wearing some trim jeans, not washed and worn at all, and a white shirt and a light gray kind of glen plaid sports jacket, three-button jacket. And he's got these clear acrylic round frames on, and his curls are kind of on the top of his head, but his hair's cut really short, the back and around the ears. Oprah is wearing this nice blue, almost blue-gray outfit, soft cashmere sweater, and matching full-legged trousers. And her hair is smooth and falls down below her shoulders. And she also has round glasses. Hers are kind of a tortoise shell. And she's got some pearl earrings and silver rings on. Since the publication of The Tipping Point as the intro, and I'm sorry, I've just read that. So let's get into the article. The last time I spoke with Malcolm Gladwell was when he came onto the Oprah show to discuss his 2005 bestseller, Blink, a book about instinct and decision-making, says Oprah. He'd already achieved the kind of household name success few authors ever earn, and each of his subsequent books, Outliers, What the Dog Saw, and David and Goliath, also became literary phenomenons that shifted our perspective on why humans behave the way they do. Then, as now, I found his ideas fascinating. Gladwell's new book, Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know, is another must-read. It investigates why we so often misconstrue others' intentions and how those errors can have unfortunate, even catastrophic consequences. One historical example, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's faulty interpretation of Hitler's motives. After their meeting, Chamberlain wrote to his sister, quote, "I got the impression that there was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word," end of quote. More recently, the 2015 confrontation between a police officer and Sandra Bland, a newcomer to the Texas town of Prairie View. The officer stopped Bland for failure to use her turn signal and wound up arresting her. She was found dead in her jail cell 3 days later. I invited Gladwell to my home in Santa Barbara to discuss why he spent the last 4 years trying to figure out not only what really led to the death of Sandra Bland in rural Texas, but also how revisiting our interpersonal miscues can help us avoid future tragedies. And here is Oprah's interview. Oprah, I have to tell you, I love this book. You're touching on so many profound themes, themes that are especially urgent now when the world seems so topsy-turvy. You have a way of turning over rocks and showing us that what's underneath isn't always what we'd expect. Malcolm Gladwell, that's what journalists and academics try to do. Give us the means to look at a familiar problem in a new way. Oprah, how did you come to decide that talking to strangers was the rock you wanted to turn over this time? Malcolm, we had that wave of police brutality cases, beginning with Michael Brown in 2014, and I was really shaken up by them. When I started to dig into it, I realized it was on a scale I'd never imagined. Roughly 1,000 civilians are killed every year by police in this country. Oprah, it's been happening forever, especially to African Americans. Malcolm, and it struck me that there's something broader at work, and that the way we were trying to make sense of it was inadequate to the task. Oprah, we also seem to be greatly moved by these incidents, but then we quickly put them behind us and forget. Malcolm, exactly. I really dislike that when these shootings occur, there's a big fuss with people oversimplifying, pointing fingers, and saying it happened because he's a bad cop, a racist. I thought that since it occurs as often as it does, maybe there's something deeper going on. Oprah, other than racism? Malcolm, in addition to, you can't separate race from police shooting cases, but you also can't say that's the whole story. There's something out of whack with the way we've structured relationships, not just between police officers and civilians, but between strangers of all kinds. Oprah, and you wanted to take a step back and say, wait a minute, Malcolm, I wondered, is there something fundamentally off with how we assess people different from ourselves? Are we bringing the wrong strategies to the problem? Oprah, you write, quote, if we were more thoughtful as a society, if we were willing to engage in some soul searching about how we approach and make sense of strangers, she, Sandra Bland, would not have ended up dead in a Texas jail cell, end of quote. Bland's a central figure here. She begins and ends the book. Tell me why. Malcolm, yes, she's the frame. Something about her case just stayed with me and still does. Oprah, and her death happened around the same time as the deaths of Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Philando Castile, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, all black men who died at the hands of the police between 2014 and 2016. Malcolm, yes, and Sandra Bland in 2015. She's this very politically aware person who had some difficulties in Chicago, but is about to start her life over after getting a new job in a lovely college town in a different state. She's leaving the campus to buy groceries when a police officer sees her and makes a judgment that there's something funny about her, so he trumps up an excuse to pull her over. Oprah, he starts out friendly, but when she lights a cigarette, he asks her to put it out, and then things go awry. Malcolm, she says legitimately, why do I have to put out my cigarette? And by the way, she hadn't done anything to warrant getting stopped. She simply made a right-hand turn out of the campus, and the officer thought there was something about her, and he pulled out and drove up really fast behind her. So she got out of the way, of course. Oprah, she did the thing we're told to do, which is to move over to the side. Malcolm, but she didn't use her blinker. When he tells her she's been stopped for that reason, she tells him she was getting out of his way, and she lights a cigarette. And after that, everything goes sideways. Oprah, and this is all caught on camera. He tries to drag her out of the car, handcuffs her. Malcolm, and puts her in jail, where she kills herself 3 days later. Oprah, we hear stories like hers. They affect us, but then people just move on. You wrote this book because you wanted us to stop, to reflect, to not move on. So how do we begin to actually shift our judgment of others? Malcolm, what I'm trying to do is systematically break down the assumptions that lead interactions between strangers to run amok. I meet you for the first time. We're two people who don't know each other. We start to have a conversation. Oprah, and we're making judgments based on our own unconscious biases, which leads us to what you refer to as, quote, the assumption of transparency, end of quote. Explain that. Malcolm, I spend a lot of time researching that concept. For instance, when I see you, I observe your demeanor, your face, your expressions, your body language, and I draw conclusions. My assumption is that the way you represent your emotions on your face and with your body language is consistent with the way you're feeling. Oprah, if you smile at me, it means you're happy. If you frown, it means you're not, right? Malcolm, right. But in the real world, the outside and inside don't always match. In the Sandra Bland case, she was justifiably annoyed at being stopped for no reason. And she got nervous, but that came across to the officer as something suspicious. He wasn't reading her behavior as nervousness. Oprah, you write about other examples of the presumption of transparency, too. Malcolm, yes, for one, the whole Amanda Knox case. When her roommate in Italy was found murdered, Amanda Knox behaved like someone who didn't care. Her inner feelings and her outward expression of emotion didn't sync up. Oprah, she came under suspicion the moment she was with other friends of the victim and didn't have the same reaction they did. Malcolm, when we deal with someone who is mismatched in this way, we're at risk of getting them very badly wrong. Oprah, you cite an incident involving your father that illustrates this point. Malcolm, yes, my parents were on vacation. They were staying at a hotel, and my father, who was 70 at the time, was in the shower when he heard my mother scream. He ran out of the shower naked, and in the room was a young man with a knife to her throat. He tells him to get out, and the guy leaves. My father's face at that moment did not betray fear, though inside he was scared as he'd ever been in his entire life. Oprah, it didn't show on the outside. Malcolm, my father's feelings of strong emotion never registered on his face. If you knew my father, you'd know that. Oprah, so your mother's assailant had no idea he was afraid. He just thought your dad was a cool customer. Malcolm, right. If you'd never met my father and you confronted him in that moment, you would think he wasn't rattled at all. In other words, you would reach exactly the wrong conclusion about him. Oprah, and that brings us to the friends fallacy. We all grew up watching sitcoms, and we see the characters exactly reflecting their feelings in their facial expressions. Malcolm, if you turn off the sound in an episode of Friends, you can still know precisely what's going on. When Monica's angry, she looks angry. When Ross is perplexed, that's how he appears. And that's how it goes for all of them. I had a psychologist who studies facial expressions analyze an episode and break it down for me. She'd take, say, a segment in which Ross is really angry and look at what his face conveyed. The answer is the perfect illustration of anger. The whole cast is able to signal a complex set of feelings on their faces alone. Oprah, because they're actors and have perfectly executed their lines. Malcolm, yes, but in real life we often wear masks to protect ourselves. And masks hide our feelings or misrepresent them to those who don't know us well. Oprah, and then there's something else, what you call the, quote, default to truth, end quote. Malcolm, there's a really interesting idea from a researcher named Timothy Levine who has rethought some of the most central issues about how human beings communicate. The core insight is that most of us are really bad at figuring out when someone is lying. Oprah, including judges. Malcolm, judges are bad at it. Cops are bad at it, too. Oprah, why is that? Malcolm, Levine's research shows that we are conditioned by evolution to assume that everyone's telling the truth unless there is overwhelming evidence to the contrary, unless doubts rise so high it's impossible to believe the person anymore. It's one reason Bernie Madoff was able to fool everyone for so long, or why people kept averting their eyes when it came to Jerry Sandusky at Penn State. Oprah, or when you suspect your spouse is being unfaithful, what usually happens when a woman asks her husband, are you cheating? Malcolm, if he offers a reasonable denial, she will default to truth. She wants to believe he's not lying. That's just how we're built. Oprah, if we weren't, the world would be a lot different. Malcolm, one reason society functions is that's our baseline. We take for granted that the person we're talking to is being honest. Oprah, speaking of honesty, we live in a time when it's hard to trust that what our leaders are saying is truthful. If you could give them a piece of wisdom that would encourage them to be truth tellers, what would it be? Malcolm, that it's okay to be wrong. Just say, I blew it. Let's try to figure out a better way. There's such a longing for grace and humility and clarity in our leaders. People want to believe in their leaders, Oprah says. Malcolm, they want to believe. Oprah, and because Sandra Bland is so important to your narrative, what would you leave us with about the tragedy? Malcolm, let's not ever forget her. Oprah, no, let's not forget her. And this book will help with that. Reading it will actually change not just how you see strangers, but how you look at yourself, the news, the world. Reading this book changed me. Thank you, Malcolm. Malcolm, thank you, Oprah. When we turn the page, we have a two-page spread of a picture under the heading, Where Are You Going? And this is a dog, which is sort of a mixed mutt, got some maybe hound dog in it. It's got, and it's face is being caressed by a raccoon. The heading is Pumpkin and Oreo, the Bahamas, and this is from Laura Young. One extremely windy day about 4 years ago, my mother noticed that a very young raccoon had fallen from its nest. She watched and waited, but the raccoon mother never returned. My mom took the baby to the vet, who told us it was a girl and that she had a broken leg. We live in the Bahamas, and our humane society is incredible but wasn't able to care for an orphaned baby raccoon, who it turned out needed to be bottle-fed every 2 hours around the clock for her first couple of months. This was an intense undertaking, but my husband and I were willing to try. We wanted to give this girl, who we named Pumpkin, a second chance at life. The only thing making me nervous was that we already had two rescue dogs, Toffee and Oreo, both of whom we'd found on the side of the road as puppies. I just hoped they'd all get along. Raccoons usually stay with their mother for a year. My intention was to rehabilitate her and then release her back into the wild. But it soon became apparent that it wasn't going to work that way. She was too entrenched in our family. The moment we brought Pumpkin inside, Oreo's motherly instinct kicked in. She even tried to nurse her. The three of them would play outside with a coconut, stealing it from one another. I'd catch Pumpkin nuzzling Toffee's nose, both of them totally serene. When she was separated from the dog, she got so anxious. Most dogs and raccoons would probably want to eat or attack each other, but these little misfits are in love. Their relationship is so uplifting and pure. These days, Pumpkin does spend more time outside. I guess she heard the call of the wild, but she doesn't like to be away from everyone for too long. When she wants to come inside, she knocks on the glass with her little fist and stares up at me, and I always open the door. As we wrap up this first installment for September, let's look at an item from Live Your Best Life, and this is called Make/Believe. One artist is sowing the seeds for a new kind of quilt. Bisa Butler is a quilting virtuoso. Just don't ask her to measure triangles for a star flower block. Butler, 46, says, quote, "I admire what old school quilters do, but if someone busts out a ruler, I feel deeply uncomfortable," end of quote. Instead of geometric patterns, Butler creates kaleidoscopic portraits of African Americans, from historical giants like Jean-Michel Basquiat or Josephine Baker to the captivating unknown. Many of her latest collages, a group of Harlem girls, each standing a little over 4 feet tall, an 1899 college baseball team, are based on archival black and white photos. Butler, who lives in West Orange, New Jersey, and may spend 20 hours layering hundreds of silk pieces to create one hyper-realistic face, says, quote, "Some have a generic title like Negro Boys on Easter Morning. I bring them back to life in color," end of quote. Every bit of fabric has symbolic impact. A swatch covered in euros signifies the cost of slavery. A ribbon printed with women standing face to face indicates sisterhood. The portraits are painterly because Butler herself was a painter. She says, quote, "Most quilters tend to see things in chunks of color. I still think in terms of layers and shadows," end of quote. While she was studying fine art at Howard University, a professor noticed a disconnect between her muted paintings and her splashy wardrobe. Picture lime green honeycombs and red and blue swirls in one dress, and urged her to start incorporating fabric into her pieces. Now, Butler, who has sewn since childhood, works only with textiles. She says, quote, "My mom and grandmother taught me so I could create Barbie outfits," end of quote. Butler's fabric collection swallows her dining room, fills 22 bins in her basement, and contains material both donated, like her mother's hijabs, and purchased. She says, quote, "If I see something I like, I buy it. I found a print called Michelle Obama's Shoes that commemorated a trip to Africa by President Obama and the First Lady, and I went ham. I was like, Michelle Obama, I'll take it in all five colors," end of quote. And across the top of the page is her quilt which is a tribute to the Birmingham church bombing, and it's called Four Little Girls, September 15th, 1963, and it was inspired by a picture taken in Harlem, and it's four little girls in their little black patent shoes and white socks, and the background, the sidewalk of this is blue and white chevron pattern, and then the background, the building behind them is pink flowers on a green background, and the flowers look like zinnias. And of course, this is all in applique, small pieces of fabric and layers and different shades. And then the girls are in bright Sunday dresses, typical of the time, little close bodices and full gathered skirts. And then there's another quilt here, a close-up of Three Kings from 2018, which she made after finding a 1939 photo of a black family. So this is just one of the people, and there's an orange background, which has been quilted in kind of a little wavy pattern, and the gentleman who's being pictured is in layers and layers of cloth, so that all the different shades are bright colors like indigo and green and teal, and he's got on a fedora and a brightly colored shirt. And the picture of Bisa shows her in a red dress with a lacy yoke, see-through yoke across the top, big gold jewelry, and long braids. And let's hear an answer to this month's question. What's the nicest thing your BFF ever did for you? And Merle McCotter of Moorhead City, North Carolina says, my friend was unable to attend the 70th birthday party my husband threw for me. So she put together photos with a narrative of our life, childhood through present day. It brought back so many wonderful memories of the years we've spent together. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-932-5138.